Welcome to the NLP View with your host, Donna Blunston. Each week, Donna will explore how the techniques of NLP can help improve your personal and professional life. And now, here's your host, Donna Blunston.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the NLP View radio show. My name is Donna Blunston. On today's show, I'm joined by the inspiring Lisa Wake to discuss her best-selling book, Neuro-Linguistic Psychotherapy, A Postmodern Perspective. Neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, is an applied psychology that was developed through the modeling of three therapists. Milton Erickson, a psychiatrist and hypnotherapist, Virginia Satir, a family therapist, and Fitz Perls, a gestalt therapist. It is believed that 80% of any result of a given behavior is produced by only 20% of input. By modeling the actions, beliefs, values, strategies, and behavioral patterns of an individual, we can identify that 20% that made the difference. This 20%, we can then replicate ourselves and achieve the same results. What was modeled is now known as the tools and techniques of NLP. Neuro-linguistic psychotherapy has been defined by McDermott and Jargo as a therapy of what is possible. It opens for the client and the therapist a voyage which is genuinely into the unknown, the purpose being to create more choices, while at the same time work towards the achievement of the client's goal. So I'd like to welcome to the show Lisa Wake. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, Donna. Are you well?
I'm fabulous, thank you. How about yourself?
Yeah, really good, thank you.
Thank you for joining me on the show today, Lisa. It's a true honour to have you as my guest. And I just want to say thank you, really, for writing your book. It places neuro-linguistic psychotherapy in context for me and considers the history of NLP and its relationship to psychotherapy. I've personally learned so much, which has not only obviously benefited me, but it's also benefited my clients and my students. So a big thank you, really.
Oh, thank you, Donna. It was a real honour, actually, to be asked to write it. So it was my first book. And being able to place it in the context of other psychotherapists felt really important to me. So, yeah, thank you for taking the time to read it.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a bit dog-eared now, I must admit. It's always on my side. I don't know, when I'm trying to explain something to students, I'll often link back to the book. And there's certain areas, actually, that I want to bring up with you through the interview, which is where I almost get a flash of yourself because I remember reading it and how you've explained it, and then I'll put that into my words to help my students. So it's been a very valuable book, as I'm sure a lot of other people will experience the same thing.
Yes.
Before we go any further, could you tell our audience more about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So my background was originally in nursing, very much like yourself, Donna, and then I moved into NHS health service management. And then from that, moved into working as a consultant doing change management. And part of becoming a change management consultant was that I recognised that often what stopped people from changing or what caused people anxiety as they were changing was some of their own psychological process, maybe some of their history, some of their baggage. So I kind of inadvertently trained at the same time in NLP psychotherapy. And I've sort of continued down that route for the last, feels like a long time, 17 years of both doing change management consultancy, but also reading and writing widely on NLP and developing a very active and interesting psychotherapy practice.
Wow. Where you've studied your NLP and the neuro-linguistic psychotherapy, would you say that the neuro-linguistic psychotherapy has very much picked up where NLP has left off, or would you identify them as being two separate modalities?
I think it's both. I think it has picked up where NLP has got itself to, in that it was originally modelled from the three therapists, then got used within the business world, in selling, in management, and NLP therapists sort of moved away from the way that NLP was being developed, and they've kind of come back to it, and through their own clinical practice, through working with clients, are finding that there are certain processes within NLP that can be applied within a therapy context and can be taken more widely as well. So I actually think mm-hmm. both.
Yeah. No, I understand that. And I agree.
And I think there's something about the the context in which the NLP is applied. So in a management context, if you're working with somebody with, for example, a desire to increase their confidence, then it's about the context of the business world, and that's where you would keep it. In the therapy world, if somebody has presented, not because they usually because they want to develop confidence, but usually because they're not confident, so it's more of a glass half empty way of looking at the world, then it's about understanding the wider context of that individual and how they've got to the point that they've got to in their life where confidence has become an issue for them. So I think the level of trust and understanding from the client is much greater in the therapeutic context, and therefore the potential for change is often greater as well.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason, I guess, where NLP is perceived in different lights, because there is the NLP business model, as you've said, in comparison to the therapeutic model. And I think a lot of the maybe the negative side that is seen now and again within NLP is from the NLP business model being trying to apply it for therapeutic reasons.
Absolutely.
And I think it's that crossover that's not meant to cross over. They are, as you say, completely different contexts.
Yes, they are. They are. And somebody who is presenting in a therapeutic context because they can't manage in their life, because they don't have necessarily the group of friends or the social network or the family network to help them through various life crises, they're already in a vulnerable position, whereas someone in the business world usually isn't in that vulnerable position. So for me, there's something about your role as a therapist and being able to sit in the relationship with the client that is so important, whereas in the management context, you can actually stay outside of the process, facilitate someone through the tools and techniques, but actually it's not so much about the relationship.
No, it's true. Very true.
Mm.
One thing I wanted to touch upon is where I alluded to in the beginning, and you've just said again, with regards to how NLP was modelled from the three therapists. And I think what links into the neurolinguistic psychotherapy against the NLP is around the when it was actually modelled. So it was modelled back in the 1970s, which is when the NLP started. And there's a difference to what was being done within the careers of Erickson and Virginia Satir, and then the films and things that were being watched from FitzPearls, and whether what was being modelled then, which was very successful, worked very effectively, but as they've developed in their own careers and their own understanding, if that was modelled again in today, would that be different?
Oh, lovely, lovely question, Donna. Yes, I think it would be different. I mean, if you take the work of Fritz Perls and you talk to anybody who's in the Gestalt Society, they'll all say that those early films and work of Fritz Perls were not the most effective ways of working therapeutically using Gestalt methodology. So Gestalt therapy has moved on a long way from how it was first created back sort of in the 1950s onwards. So I think Fritz Perls was working very differently at the time of his death compared to, you know, how he was in the very early days. Same with regard to Milton Erickson. Erickson himself, in one of the books by Bandler and Grinder, actually says that these modellers have taken an element of what he does and identified, yes, there are some good processes. And actually, he's doing much more than that. And I'm currently doing my own doctorate, and I'm looking at Erickson's work and the work of therapists who are using NLP. And all of them are recognising that they're actually doing something that's way beyond the linguistic patterns of NLP that were first modelled out.
Mm. Yes, that's something that I very much recognise, and as well as you go on to explain that, and the other people that were being modelled and that were doing similar stuff at the same time, because both they learnt and developed themselves through the work of other people. So it's what else provided that foundation that was modelled then, let alone where it's created now.
Well, if you look at the early modelling work, it wasn't just Bandler Grinder. There was also Frank Puchalik there modelling, Robert Dilt, Steve Gilligan, Bill O'Hanlon. So someone like Bill has worked avidly in developing a solution-focused way of working through his possibility-based therapy that was very, very Ericksonian. If you look at any of the old videotapes of Erickson and then you attend one of O'Hanlon's workshops, or you know, look at some of the videos of O'Hanlon, it's like it's Erickson but on you know, something that's speeding him up slightly. Erickson on caffeine or speed or something like that. Not that Bill, I'm sure, uses anything like that. But it is, he's taken the joy of working in the relationship and the real love and compassion for people and has brought it into possibility therapy. So how could O'Hanlon observe Erickson, Gilligan observe Erickson, and then Bandler and Grinder observe Erickson, and all three of them come out with different models? You know, by any experience that we have, we all have our own version of it, and there is no such thing as the reality. It's our interpretation.
Completely. And I guess it's, as you say, we all see what we want to see and apply what we want to apply in the different areas as to what. So it's all around what is important and what you believe in and what interests you.
Yeah, and if, you know, I spent quite a bit of time talking via email to Betty Alice Erickson, who was Milton's daughter as I wrote the attachment book. And Betty Alice was really avid at the very beginning to say, I'll talk to you, but as long as you'll listen to me, because I'm my dad's daughter, my father's daughter, and I've got a close representation of what it was like for him and how he viewed it and what he really thought about NLP, which I'm not going to do on air. And Betty Alice, there was a real desire to bring in that holistic therapeutic approach that her father used with clients that you can't model out. You can't say that's the difference that makes the difference in therapy.
And that's where the psychotherapy comes in, doesn't it? Because there is, and that, as you say, the holistic assessment, because it's not just what, it's not just what we see and you've done X, X equals this, so that's how you do it. It is the bigger picture and the bits that you pick up that you might not even consciously be aware that you've picked up. You've just done it because that was the right thing to do with you and your own knowledge as the coach there or therapist there supporting the patient.
Absolutely. And what you might do as a therapist in that context would be very different to what I would do, would be very different to what another therapist would do. It's, you know, this is something that Steve Gilligan talks about. It's that co-created reality. And, you know, Steve tells a lovely story of, and whether it's true or not, it doesn't matter. I just think it's a nice story where he says to Erickson, Dr. Erickson, can you tell me what psychotherapy is? And according to Steve, Erickson looked over the top of his glasses and said, well, young man, what I'm going to say to you is therapy is where two people get together in the same room and they both try and figure out what on earth is going on. And I think, you know, the what is going on will be different according to the therapist that's working with the client. Now, that isn't to devalue NLP or to say, you know, it can't work or it doesn't work. I think the application of the tools of NLP are incredibly powerful in the right hands and in the right context.
I couldn't agree more. I think one of the beauties within NLP for me, certainly, is around the linguistics of it. And I think that's mainly because it excites me, especially as I've come from somebody who didn't particularly like English, which is quite a turnaround, really. And I think it's the reason why it excites me is because of the curiosity and the removal of assumptions that NLP teaches you. And I think that's the difference with the therapy from my perspective, as far as it promotes you to elicit clarification on what's being said. So for those two therapists sat in the room together, what must be happening for that person? It's filling in all the gaps, because we all assume things without realising we assume. Things have got to happen in order for sentences to make sense. But if we take away our presumptions and what we've assumed, we're left with the rawness of what's actually there. And that's when the two people can work together properly. How do you use that tool of the removal of presumptions, the linguistic presuppositions in the way you work, and how do you think it applies to both?
I think it might be useful for me to give you a case example, you know, on this, of not just what is being said, but also what's not being said and how it's being said. So there's a client that I'm seeing currently who has a very traumatic history, has been bullied in various ways that have been from very deep sort of abusive episodes in a very early childhood through to abusive and traumatic relationships in her adult life. And those still continue, and she's a lady in her middle years. And in her therapeutic sessions, she would say very little verbally, almost nothing. So anything that I asked would be met with, I don't know, I'm not sure, I can't go there. It's a real sort of conscious block. There's a lot of not saying anything linguistically, but verbally saying huge amounts. So she would sit with a scarf tightly wrapped around her neck. She would always curl up in the chair. So there's a real holding and containing of herself in the room for fear of something being let out. She would always have a cup of tea in the session, and she'd never drink the tea, but she'd spill it down herself. And so she'd always leave with half of it spilt down herself and half of it sat on the table. So linguistically, there wasn't a lot to work with, but through the non-verbal language that she was representing, there was a huge amount around not being able to express things, around not really taking care of her own body, that she'd spill hot tea over it and not even be aware of it. And in her sessions, 45 minutes without fail after leaving her session, I'd get an email from her with a long story about what was going on in her mind. And it was always 45 minutes later from a local service station. And so I started to challenge her on this of, in 45 minutes, I'm going to get an email from you telling me what you wanted to talk about in the session, but you wait until you're out of the session. So the only place she could feel safe to explore what was going on for her psychologically was when she wasn't in the room. So some real distancing and dissociation. I saw her earlier this week, and in the session, she again was in that place of not really wanting to talk, and had been sending me emails saying, please bully me, please, I want you to metaphorically beat me up so that I deal with this stuff. And I kept emailing her back and saying, I'm not going to bully you, you've had enough of that in your lifetime, I am here to love you, care for you, respond to you and value you and respect you as a human being. So we've gone through these emails over several weeks. And then she came to the session this week begging me to bully her so that she could get in touch with her emotions. And I point blank refused. I then started to tell her a story, a metaphor around understanding where she was at. And she then started to talk to me about her first marriage. And it's the first time in 6 months that she's actually mentioned her first husband's name. So I thought, OK, we're getting somewhere. And a couple of times she kind of looked away from me, and it appeared to be quite clear that the emotion was coming up for her, but she still wasn't willing to talk about it. At the end of the session, half a tea had still gone down her top. There was still half of it left undrunk. The scarf was still tightly wrapped around her, but I felt that there was something different. Now, unusually for me, I had to leave the office straight afterwards, and I followed her car down the motorway. And in following her down the motorway back to where I had an appointment and where she turned off, and she didn't know I was following me, I became incredibly concerned about her driving ability. She was all over the road. A couple of times she almost hit cars. And I'm thinking, I'd better just follow her because I really don't know what's going on for this lady. She then pulled off, and I felt huge anxiety at the same time as well. She then pulled off the motorway at the same junction that I pulled off. I continued another way for an appointment, and she went in the direction towards where she lived. About an hour later, I got an email from her describing the fact that the first time she became fully aware of how frightened she was of her bullying husband was when he was driving. That he had been the kind of driver that would, and he had addiction problems with both alcohol and drugs, and he would drive the car violently. He would go up behind people on the motorway and actually speed and try and move them out of the way by hitting their tailgate with his front bumper. And so she opened all of this up to me in the email. And for me, the, you know, if we go back to what's being said and what's not being said, she has been begging me to bully her. I said to her, I can see where you're at, told her a metaphor, a story around feeling safe, told her that there was no way I was going to bully her, that I wanted to come from a place of love and respect and care for her. That then enabled her to open up that story that she kept locked in for so long. And so now we're back into her coming back next week to start to work on that emotional state. Now, for her, unconsciously, the only way she could communicate that story was to unconsciously do it on the road. She didn't know I was following her, but why that point in time did she choose to drive in that way so that I could witness it? So our clients will have the most amazing ways of telling us their story that isn't the linguistic representation that comes in the room.
Very true. Very true. Seen a lot. And I think the biggest valid point is what isn't being said. And it is that curiosity and what else must be happening. And for you to be in that position where you can see that enables her, I guess, to then explore it even further.
And there is, for me, something about how, as a therapist, we don't repeat the trauma. We don't become the abuser, the perpetrator, the protagonist of the client's own nightmare. And so, again, you know, if we go to the difference between NLP coaching or NLP in the business world and NLP therapeutically, it, for me, the role of the therapist is to understand the context in which the client's life has been created and to ensure that they don't repeat that pattern of whoever the protagonist or the abuser or the tormentor has been for the client, and to stay clean within that, listening to the linguistic structure, listening to the nonverbal communication and the stuff that isn't being said. All of that will give us clues to how this person relates to their external world.
Once worked with that lady in this case, or with other people, there'll have been a lot of years where they'll have learnt how to behave, they'll have learnt patterns of behaviour in a way to respond to their traumas, whether that be a physical or emotional or neglectful trauma. They'll have learnt new ways ways to behave. So I guess then the follow-on then responsibility in a way for the therapist is what to do next, how to support them into the future of their world. Which I guess what's lead me on to really, where I wanted to talk about the repatterning that you described so beautifully in your book, which is one thing that I use a lot. I think it's very, very powerful. And it's that that safeness of taking the now and how you want to lay down new neurological pathways for that person so that they've got new options and new choices and new ways of doing things rather than going back over what they have done and what they have learnt in the past. We can do so much to, in a way, remove the negative links looking from a Gestalt therapist perspective. We can support that and remove all that, but it's then where do we go now? Because that person, as they are today, has developed to that point from the past behind them. So where would you then take the repatterning perspective in order to support this person in the future?
You mean the young lady?
Mm.
Yeah. With her, for me, it's about creating a safe space for it to be okay for her to have emotions. So one of the things that she talks about as a child, which we did touch on in the session this week, was she stayed silent for a very long time. And then sometimes when it became unbearable as a sort of 7, 8, 9-year-old, she used to sit on the stairs in the family home and just scream. She would just scream for hours on end as a way of just letting these feelings out of herself. And as an adult, one of the things that she does as a way of obsessively being in the emotion and feeling it is she'll obsessively exercise. So she'll cycle 100 miles in a week or 120 miles, which is a fairly obsessive, you know, she's not a sports, you know, competitive sports person. It's just something that she obsessively does. So part of her repatterning is about recognizing that dissociation, in other words, disconnection from feelings, and the management of that hyper excitability, the fact that she's constantly alert and aware, become something that we've almost got to find the opposite of that. How can she learn to be? How can she learn to be in the moment? And one of the things that I'm starting to do with her is to talk to her about her mountain. It's not really a mountain, it's just a very large hill in England, but for her it's a mountain. And so we talk about how she can use that mountain, how she can walk up there and be with the silence. And by being with silence, which is that lovely internal state that she can have of almost being in a relaxed state for herself, that there's still busyness. And she, where she lives in the north of England, she overlooks a conurbation of three cities that sort of have this hill between them. And how can she look down and still see the business in the cities and be with silence? Now, this is a lady that's been incredibly busy disconnecting from her feelings. And so what we're doing from a repatterning point of view is saying, actually, there is a stillness. You can still find the stillness, even though there's busyness there. So to move from hyper-excitable and dissociated to just being still is too big a step. And actually, it's about finding those little steps in between. And almost joining up the dots, that both states can be present in the person at the same time. I mean, there's one of the men that I talk about in the book who had disconnected from his child self many, many years ago. And again, part of his repatterning was to change his hyper excitability response, where he always liked to use cocaine as a substance to give him additional confidence when he was feeling hyper anxious. We found an activity that he could do that was still in the risk-taking category but wasn't affecting his health so much, and he actually took up horse riding. And at the same time, he was still fighting with his younger version of himself that was very, very frightened. And we did some integration work with this part of his psyche that was disconnected. And we ended up with an 8-year-old in the room with us. So we had the 8-year-old sat in one chair and him sat in the other chair and having a conversation. And traditional NLP would say client has to integrate their part. You know, they're not allowed to go out of the room with their part still hanging out. Well, I don't think that works. You know, this 8-year-old has been disconnected from him for over 20 years. He's not going to allow it to come back inside. And again, someone who lives in the north of England, and it was the winter time, and I used to occasionally pass him on the local highway, and he had a sports car, and the sunroof would always be down, and it's like freezing cold in the middle of winter. And when he came back into the session, I said to him, well, I've seen you a few times on the highway, and you know, I noticed that you've got your sunroof down, you're a brave guy. And he said, no, he said, you know that 8-year-old that you've told me to take care of? Well, he loves the idea. So he sits in the seat next to me, and it took him about 3 or 4 months of giving himself permission to let his 8-year-old play. Yeah. Once he was able to do that, then he could start to grow up the 8-year-old. You know, and I've had female clients where they found their 4-year-old little girl inside themselves that's been disconnected for 30, 40, 50 years, and they go home with permission, and they have makeup parties, or they get their clothes out, or they have a girly sleepover. And yeah, that's what I'm talking about from a repatterning point of view, that therapeutically there are things that we can do in the session, and actually it's about giving the client the context outside of the session to literally repattern how they respond in different contexts.
It's that permission, I think, is the biggest word there, and the key to a lot of it is giving them permission to heal and to be themselves, which is something that you'll have to come back and join me again, Lisa, so we can talk even more about it. Our half an hour's flown. Would you be able to tell our audience how they can get in touch with you, your website details, and where they can buy your book from?
Certainly. So my website details are www.awakenconsulting, that's awakenconsulting.co.uk. You can do a direct contact with me via that. Just let me know that you've heard me on the radio show. And Amazon, as ever, for the book, or an author-signed copy. Do have them in the office as well. So, and Donna, it has been a real pleasure to speak to you again. You're a wonderful lady and you're doing great.
Oh, thank you. Thank you ever so much, Lisa. And thank you to all of our audience for tuning in today. If you'd like to learn more about NLP, then tune in each week and also visit my website, www.donnablunston.com, where you'll be able to pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Psychobabble, a straightforward, plain English guide to the benefits of NLP. Also visit theorganicview.com and sign up for our newsletter, which will keep you updated with the up-and-coming shows, guests and online workshops. You'll also be able to follow us online, Twitter at the NLP View and Facebook / the NLP View. Thanks for tuning in. Bye.